It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll follow a Wisconsin cartoonist from his upbringing on a dairy farm to the pages of the New Yorker magazine.
First, an environmental organization is calling on the Environmental Protection Agency to give more oversight to the state's Department of Natural Resources.
In a new petition to the EPA, 16 residents around the state, represented by Midwest environmental advocates, say the DNR hasn't been doing enough to protect water quality in the state, in part because of recent limits to its authority. As a result, they say Wisconsin is not meeting its obligations under the Clean Water Act.
Kimberly Wright joins us now. She's Executive Director of Midwest Environmental Advocates. Kimberly, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So in this petition, you say that the DNR is falling short on water quality protection. What are some of the ways that you see that happening at the DNR?
Well, it's a pretty complicated program, so there are many ways that the law isn't being followed. I think it's good to start with that I think it's complicated for people to understand that laws don't enforce themselves. So these are laws that have objective technical standards for creating permits that guide pollution to our public waters. And it's been a downhill slide for about 10 years, but in recent years that's accelerated. So it's everything from not using proper calculations for certain pollutants that enter the water, and actually some of the most disturbing deficiencies are citizens' rights to participate. We've spent as much time in representing people to participate in their own government as we have on some of the substantive issues.
Has the DNR been given a chance to address the issues before the EPA was petitioned?
Yeah, we certainly didn't take this lightly. 4 years ago in July, the EPA put the DNR on notice that the program was out of compliance with the federal law. And the DNR so far has missed the deadlines and in reaching accountability.
So in a little more detail there, why petition the EPA to look more closely at these concerns now?
Because this is federal law that is administered by the state, so it's a delegated authority, and by receiving that authority, the state must meet the minimum standards in the law. And it's important to remember these are public health standards. It's how much poison can you put in the water before people get sick or die. So they're pretty important standards to meet.
Is there precedent for other states going to the EPA and having the EPA potentially step in like this?
Yes. I mean, it's part of the federal law that citizens do have a right to petition the EPA if their state isn't meeting the standards. Again, it's not something we take lightly. Our organization has been representing citizens in litigation on a lot of these issues for the last 5 years, and many of the petitioners, actually all of the petitioners, have worked for years in their communities through all of the channels available to them. So, you know, it's too important. Our water really can't wait. So it just is time to go to the EPA and ask them to fulfill their oversight duty.
Any particular states that you're aware of that have done this?
Yeah, there's, to my knowledge, there's about 40 petitions over the 43-year history of the Clean Water Act. And so really what we're asking and what we would like is that the EPA bring the DNR into compliance through oversight, or if that can't happen in a reasonable time limit, and we've already had quite a few years, that the EPA take that authority back.
We're talking with Kimberly Wright right now, Executive Director of Midwest Environmental Advocates, and we're talking about a new petition asking the EPA to provide more oversight on water quality issues in Wisconsin. And Kimberly, there have been recent changes at the DNR, among other things, moving water quality protection to a new division of the agency. Do you see that as being part of the issue here?
Yeah, I think it just compounds the existing issues. And a big part of this is that the DNR, there's great men and women with great expertise and experience to do their jobs. They have been starved of resources, and over the years just really don't have the professional autonomy for science-based decision-making. Special interest politics has reached pretty deeply into our public science agency.
And who will be in charge, as far as you know, with this new reorganization? Who is going to be in charge, what aspect of the DNR, of overseeing some of these problem areas that you've talked about, like discharge of pollutants into waterways?
Well, the last I heard, it's a little bifurcated, but that the air, what had been the air division will be rolling water in, but then there's also a business services division in the secretary's office, so it gets a little complex.
What are you hoping the EPA is going to do in response to this petition, and what are you asking as a first step?
Well, the petition is 87 pages long with great detail of the technical failings, so we would like them to address those issues. And one of the first things that we would like the EPA to do is to hold public hearings in Wisconsin. Again, we are the state with a great conservation history and a lot of citizen action. And there are people all over the state, every corner of the state, working for clean water in their communities. And, you know, they deserve to be heard.
Now, you said that this is not something you want to mess around with. This is the state's water. And if it's have toxins in it, people get sick and die. Can you tell us what you see as being at stake here? More detail about that water supply.
Well, there are lots of problems in rural areas with people on private wells from agricultural runoff, lots and lots of nitrate pollution above safe drinking water standards. In parts of the state where there are industrial livestock facilities, people have manure, E. coli in their wells. And then I think everyone in Wisconsin has experienced water that is choked with algae where, you know, you can't use the water. If you live near the water, your property values are down. You know, the DNA, our Wisconsin DNA is all about water. And there's a lot of places in the state where it's very difficult to enjoy our water.
Now, Governor Walker and members of his administration have said that the DNR has been maybe overregulated in the past, maybe to the detriment of business interests, maybe the economy. Has that been a problem in Wisconsin in the past as you see it?
No, and I think you have to ask whose business you're talking about. We know so many people around the state whose water-based businesses are really in trouble, property values down. Government needs to balance all interests within the technical standards of the law, not pick winners and losers.
And Kimberly, just very briefly as we wrap up, what are you looking for the next steps with this petition?
Well, we will be waiting for what the EPA has to say, but more importantly, we want the people of Wisconsin to understand how important their voices are. Most people assume their government protects their water, and that's a reasonable assumption. And we want people to really speak up to elected officials at every level of government and let them know they're concerned about water quality.
Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Kimberly Wright, Executive Director of Midwest Environmental Advocates, talking about a new petition asking the EPA to provide more oversight to the DNR on water quality issues in Wisconsin.
The worlds of rural Wisconsin and the New Yorker magazine may not cross paths often, but our next guest is an exception.
Liam Francis Walsh grew up on a farm here in the state, and in the course of his life, he set a very specific goal. He wanted to be a cartoonist for the New Yorker, the pinnacle of ironic, single-panel, humorous cartoons.
And now he's done it. Liam Francis Walsh is an illustrator and writer. His work appears in The New Yorker and elsewhere. His children's book, titled Fish, is due out next year. You can see some of his work, by the way, linked on the Central Time Facebook page. He joins us from Switzerland, where he now lives. Liam, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before you were a cartoonist appearing in a big city magazine, you were a kid growing up in rural Wisconsin. Now, whereabouts did you grow up?
I grew up not far from Wheeler, Wisconsin, which is not far from Boyceville, Wisconsin, which is not far from Menominee, Wisconsin, which people may have heard of.
And you were on a dairy farm growing up, is that right?
That's right, yeah, yeah. We had cows and chickens and pigs different years, had honeybees, we made maple syrup, ground our own cornmeal, all of that stuff. So basically just the average, basic 1980s Wisconsin childhood.
As I understand it, though, from your website, you had a pet crow at some point in there?
I did, yeah. I know it sounds stranger than fiction, but a man from our church who was blind climbed a tree and got it for me. Yeah, I don't know if he got it for other kids or not, but that was the story.
And the crow, did it live inside or in your yard?
It was in a cage part of the time, and then it would hang out on my wrist and walk around with me. I had a work glove, a leather glove, that it would just perch on. And then one time, eventually, I guess it was sort of for a summer that I had it, and at the end of the summer, as far as I knew, it sort of flew away, and we said, well, that's nature. My mom told me when I was an adult that that she saw it get taken by a hawk.
Oh, no.
She didn't tell me until I was grown.
Well, how did you get started on the path from the dairy farm to being a cartoonist?
You know, I maybe vaguely remember seeing The New Yorker at the laundromat as a kid, but I don't remember too much. Maybe a few Charles Adams cartoons here and there. I think my grandparents had a book of his stuff. But, yeah, it wasn't really part of our life growing up. When I was in the Virgin Islands, I guess growing up, I eventually moved to northern Wisconsin and lived on a lake, and I was really into sailing, and so got really into this idea of, you know, going to sea, as it were, and eventually left and went to Florida and worked on boats and found my way to the Caribbean. And there, a lot of the tourists from New York would leave their New Yorkers behind, and I would pick them up and sort of fell in love with the magazine. This was during a time, the Caribbean is known for many things, but having great access to the news and to media isn't one of them. So this was where I was sort of discovering what was going on in the invasion of Iraq and then, you know, the secret stuff going on behind the scenes. And I was really blown away by this magazine that seemed to be so deep compared to the fairly shallow Caribbean lifestyle of drinking and swimming. And I fell in love with the magazine, and then I suspected they probably weren't going to invite me to write for them, but I thought maybe cartooning was something I could do.
So you didn't set out to be a cartoonist and see where it led. You wanted to be a cartoonist in The New Yorker.
Yeah, those were the cartoons that interested me, and frankly, they still interest me. Definitely lots of other publications have had wonderful cartoonists and wonderful cartoons, but your basic average cartoon didn't interest me so much as that there was something kind of interesting going on in The New Yorker. There was something different going on that I found to be intriguing, smart, funny in a way that made you think. And of course, not all of them are like that. I'll be the first to admit that not all of them are even comprehensible. But at their best, there was something special about them.
Yeah, that's a running joke sometimes. I think it happened on Seinfeld, the inscrutability of those New Yorker comics. Is that something that you try to avoid in yours?
I do. You know, every once in a while, somebody says they just don't get mine, but it's not because I made it purposely inscrutable. It's because somehow it didn't communicate properly. I do think that sometimes they put ones in there that are kind of inscrutable. They like that mystique.
How did you get your foot in the door there? You had one object, and you made it happen.
Yeah, looking back, it all seems like it was so simple, but actually it was years and years of sending cartoons off to what seemed like the void. One winter I was came home to Wisconsin and was staying with my mom while she was recovering from a surgery, and it was winter in Wisconsin, as everybody knows, and I was inside a lot and started drawing cartoons and sending them out. And, you know, 5 years later, I finally sold one.
We're talking to Liam Francis Walsh, originally of or near Wheeler, Wisconsin, now a cartoonist, often appearing in The New Yorker. Liam, I understand that as of a couple of years ago, you did not own a smartphone. Is that still true?
You know, it's funny. I was talking to a friend of mine about how, you know, everybody needs a narrative, and my narrative seemed to be that I was a Luddite. I would say it's more that I'm a slow adopter or a late adopter. I do have a smartphone, yeah.
You so, do now, so okay.
Breaking news.
but a lot of your cartoons, I think this made people look at that because a lot of your cartoons seem to focus on the role of technology in our lives, our preoccupation with technology. Why is that such rich ground for humor these days?
I guess it's one of those things that is so many of the tropes of comedy and of the New Yorker the iconic New Yorker cartoon in particular, are really... They're not necessarily particularly fertile anymore. They've been fertile for decades, like the guy at the therapist or something. And I've done those cartoons, and they're fun. I did one this week, in fact. But it's fun to... It might be a little bit easier to get a fresh idea when there's actually a fresh thing in the news, thing going on and all around us. Gosh, if there's one thing going on around us, it's everybody checking their smartphone. So... And I guess that was maybe a little bit, when I didn't have a phone, it was a little bit snotty of me, too, to sort of be a little bit superior to people. So I guess, maybe, I'm not sure, but I found it very funny and very, ubiquitous.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to convey cartoons on the radio. I'll try with one of yours. A couple are on a tour. They're looking at the Statue of Liberty, and one holds up a phone and says, "Look at the picture I took of the thing we're looking at." That's the kind of thing that strikes you about how technology shows up in our lives, it seems like.
Hey, well, it's funny you choose that one, because actually, I'm speaking to you from my mother-in-law's house, and she inspired that one.
Oh, really?
She's from Switzerland, and she was visiting in New York, and we were in Central Park, and we kept stopping every 2 minutes for her to snap a picture and then show us. And she's wonderful, but that was definitely, you know, that sort of snotty side that comes out where in your head you go, right, look at the picture of the thing we're looking at. So not all of them are that organic. Not all of them come like that. Sometimes it's just coming up with a funny picture and then trying to think of how to tie it all together, but that was a very autobiographical one.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the process there, because there was a video of you online talking about how your ideas emerge, and it involves lots of little notebooks, it sounds like.
Tons of little notebooks. When I just moved from New York, and I had to pack all of these little notebooks in somewhere. And it's funny, I still go through them and find all sorts of little tidbits that can turn into, that aren't necessarily ideas yet, but can maybe spark something. And maybe something that was almost an idea then can catch fire from something that's going through my head now. It's great. That's the number one thing I think that made me into a cartoonist was when into taking myself seriously as anything artistic was when I started taking my ideas seriously and writing them down instead of letting them flit away.
And say you, after we get off the phone here, if you put something in a notebook now, it might never be anything. It might lead to something next week, or you might look back at it in a year, and it'll develop into a different idea.
Exactly. I mean, there's a very good chance. It's probably 90% chance that it'll never be anything. Although maybe that's not true, because maybe as soon as you start writing, you start thinking, and it's a good way to think, and so you don't know whether it's going to actually have anything. I may not necessarily know that it's because I jotted that thing in my notebook last week, so I might say that was a waste, but the reality is that it all adds up to thinking.
This might be a lesson for any creative person out there, or would-be creative person. If you want to be a cartoonist, start drawing stuff.
You know, it's funny. If people push that idea a lot, just to start drawing stuff or start writing. Either way, I guess one is visual and the other is less so. But somehow I feel like starting to let your thoughts string out instead of being this sort of vague mist in your head. Once you start putting them on paper, you got to start thinking about them, whether it's the drawing or the writing, and you got to start putting one thought after another. It's really the same. And you really got to take it seriously and make it work, because a drawing that's half done is only half done, whereas a thought that's half done, kind of, you might be able to fool yourself that it's done.
Now, you've been drawing cartoons for adults, not adult comics, I guess, exactly, but in The New Yorker. You've got a children's book coming out next year called A Fish. What's different about tackling a children's-oriented project?
You know, my agent, Dan, who's really great and who really encouraged me into this, and who really gave me tons of feedback. He encouraged me to try to think of each page as a cartoon, with children, which I don't have any, but I have a lot of nieces and nephews, and I like to spend time with them. And then, you know, they don't have the greatest attention span, and so he wanted every page to try to be a cartoon. Something has to happen every page. Every time you turn the page, there's something fresh happening. We're not spending three or four pages dithering and like Hamlet, where it's got to charge forward. And so that was really how he related, or how I related those two things together. But the fact of the matter is that some ideas don't work well in a single panel. And so I was always interested in comics. I always read comics. And the picture book is a little bit like that, just where each page is a panel instead of having, nine panels on a page.
Now, your travels, your life, have taken you from Wisconsin to New York. You mentioned the Caribbean, Switzerland. Is there still something uniquely, you think, Wisconsin or Midwestern that is a part of your creative life?
You know, I take lots of walks. I love nature, and I grew up in the countryside. So, seeing birds, seeing the cows, and they actually wear bells around their necks, so it's really like a fairy tale. lots of that stuff is very Wisconsin-y. I think that I don't know if it's something that Wisconsin people are proud of or not, or too humble to. But Wisconsin people are really nice, and I always, whether it be creatively or otherwise, I always tried to bring that friendliness and that niceness, and still try to bring it to Switzerland. and creatively as well, that I wouldn't necessarily, it might keep me from ever being on the cutting edge, but I wouldn't necessarily want to write a book or a cartoon that my mom wouldn't look at, you know.
Liam, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Liam Francis Walsh, cartoonist, contributor to The New Yorker magazine, and author of the children's book Fish, due out in 2016.
In recent years, electronic cigarettes, or e-cigs, have seen an explosion in popularity. Initially created as a smoking cessation aid, they've now become a popular consumer product, and a whole vaping industry is springing up across the U.S. to meet that growing demand.
Despite being marketed as a safer alternative to traditional cigarettes, there have been concerns over the safety of the products, especially as more young people turn to them. Now, a new investigation by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel looks at what's in e-cigarette liquid, or smoke juice, as some call it, finds that there might be more harmful chemicals in these liquids than what industry testing has suggested.
Joining us now is Raquel Rutledge. She's a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Raquel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for your interest in the story.
So let's talk generally first about e-cigarettes for a moment. Now, it seems as though usage has been surging in recent years, lots of vaping shops popping up around cities. How big of a growth rate have we been seeing here?
Well, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention does a youth survey analysis of tobacco use, and they have seen the numbers triple in the last, from 2013 to 2014, of folks who have tried e-cigarettes. Now, and we did our own survey of Marquette University students just to sort of gauge, you know, is it getting on the college campuses? What are their perspectives on it? And we found that more college students had tried an e-cigarette than had tried a conventional tobacco cigarette. So there is a lot of interest in it. It is being marketed as something as somewhat safer, and some are marketing it that way. And, you know, it's very attractive with all these different, you know, cheesecake flavors and cherries and bubble gum and cotton candy type flavors. So it is attracting youth for sure.
Now, the whole flavor profile that you just described there relies on liquid, or another nickname for that is smoke juice. Tell us a little bit about what these e-liquids are and how they work.
Well, they are typically a base of either vegetable glycerin or propylene glycol, and they are then typically mixed with, different levels of nicotine. Not always. You can get them, you know, the goal, I think, for some folks is to get, you know, wean off the nicotine and not have any nicotine in there. But you can buy nicotine in different levels. And then more often than not, added with a flavor. So you can get, there are thousands of flavors out there to choose from.
And tell us about the ones that you chose to test for your investigation.
We randomly selected some around just locally made around Milwaukee, because there have been studies out there. Last year there was a study done by a cardiologist in Greece who is very interested in e-cigarettes, and he studied 159 different flavors from 30 something manufacturers in 7 different countries. So he did kind of a wide look, mostly at sweet flavored ones though. So he did focus on the sweet flavored ones, because those are the ones that are typically known to have diacetyl and 2,3-pentanedione, which are the compounds that we're talking about here. And so we wanted to sort of get an idea on what's going on locally. How are these things being made? Because a lot of folks will make them right in their shop, in their vape shops right there in the back of the store, or sometimes right out in the front. Or they, you know, they have another lab do it for them. So we just wanted to see what was going on in the local markets. And so we just picked 5 flavors that the store clerk said were popular. We just said, hey, show us your best-selling stuff. And they, you know, they picked these 5 flavors, and we tested them for those 2 compounds.
So you've got those 2 chemicals, and we'll come back to them, and the other ones as well. Now, but the 2 that we're talking about, diacetyl and the other one that I'm going to let you pronounce, there's questions about the levels of what's in those. So tell us again what they are and what the concerns are.
Well, diacetyl has been studied more than 2,3-pentanedione, and 2,3-pentanedione is a chemical cousin. It's one molecule different than diacetyl, and they're both used widely in the food industry for their ability to impart a butter flavor. They are used for microwave popcorn. They are used in candies and baking, and they actually are formed naturally. They're a byproduct from fermentation, and so they've been they've given the sort of the green light that the FDA has, you know, to say you can eat this in trace amounts. They have not been studied for inhalation. They, nobody has endorsed them to say it's okay to inhale them. So it's very different. And diacetyl was got a lot of attention back in the early 2000s when the microwave popcorn workers started coming down with this illness called bronchiolitis obliterans, which is essentially when your bronchioles get obliterated by this by diacetyl. It attacks those tiniest airways, the small airways, and as your body tries to heal, it builds up scar tissue, and it's irreversible. So that's what diacetyl has been known for that over the years, and studies on animals and epidemiological studies on workers have been done. Now, 2,3-pentanedione has been used as a replacement as the food manufacturers started to steer away from diacetyl. There's been a ton of litigation. Multi-million-dollar lawsuits have been settled. So manufacturers are moving away from diacetyl, and they've been using 2,3-pentanedione as a substitute. Well, animal studies have now shown, and because they are so close, their chemical structure, the toxicology studies are coming back saying, hey, these are equally, the 2,3-pentanedione is equally as destructive to the lungs.
We're talking to Raquel Rutledge right now of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about their recent investigation revealing that popular e-cigarette liquids contain harmful chemicals, often without buyers and sellers being aware of it. So, Raquel, you've got these five different flavors, these e-liquids that you're testing for these two particular chemicals, diacetyl and 2,3-pentanedione. So where did you take them to be tested?
We started out having them tested at Marquette University, their chemistry department. The chair of the department, Scott Reed, offered to do that for us and take a look at what was in them. And so he did that, and he used a very sensitive method of testing. He derivatized these compounds, which essentially you mix them with another compound to make bigger and easier to capture. So he did that. Then he put them through a mass spectrometry machine. And was able to detect both of those chemicals in all of the samples that we gave him. And then we wanted to also send them to another lab, which does a lot of the testing for the e-liquid industry, and that is a lab out in North Carolina called Enthalpy Labs. And they do, like I said, a bulk of the testing across the country and for Canada as well. And we only sent three. We sent our three highest ones to them. The ones that were just, we thought, oh, these are the highest ones, let's see what they say. So we did send it to them. And what is standard in their industry, what their folks told us, is that they don't detect as low of a level because, not that they can't, they're certainly capable of detecting lower levels. But the process that Marquette used takes a little bit longer. It takes 6 hours to derivatize. It's a little more expensive, a little more time-consuming, labor-intensive. So they don't do that. The industry has not asked them to do that. So they're basically responding to what their clients want, which is we want to know, you know, how much is in there at parts per million. So they don't typically go down into the lower levels. So when they have a non-detect, that doesn't mean there is no diacetyl or 2,3-pentanedione in there. If you're an e-liquid maker and you send it to Enthalpy and say, hey, you know, do we have diacetyl? Do we have a problem here? If you don't specifically tell them, you know, there has to be a will to want to detect lower levels. And they don't, for the most part. They leave it at parts per million. And that is, it's a long explanation. I don't know if you want me to get into why they do that, but I certainly can if you're interested. I can get way in the weeds on this stuff.
Well, let's look at some of the bigger picture questions first, and we'll see if we end up there eventually. But so you've got these e-cigarettes, you're finding elements of these chemicals in them. Is the expectation already going in, at least to consumers and to sellers, that these products are free of these chemicals? Does it say anything like that on the packaging?
There are times when it does say they are diacetyl-free or 2,3-pentanedione-free, and when we have found that they're not, that does happen. It doesn't always. I don't know what the expectation is. I think there's a lot of misinformation and a lot of just lack of information. Some folks have never heard those words. Some vapors, there's folks that, you know, are even heavy vapors, haven't even heard of them, are not asking about it, aren't concerned about it, don't know about it. Others are, and there were some cases where I think the expectation was that it was diacetyl-free because they would say, some of the labels used to say FDA approved, they would have a label on it, said FDA approved, you know, for generally recognized as safe. And there have been letters, the flavor manufacturing industry wrote cease and desist letters and told them to stop marketing it that way because they've only been approved for ingestion, for eating, not inhalation.
So is anybody regulating? Is anybody regulating these chemicals in specifically e-cigarettes?
No.
So no one's regulating them. So it's up to who to enforce the chemicals? Just the sellers themselves?
Yeah, nobody is. Nobody. I mean, there are some trade associations that are cropping up, certainly in the United States and in Canada, where they are trying to set standards because they're realizing as an industry that this is an issue. And so they're trying to come up with testing standards. In Canada, they have a trade association that requires all the members, and they've got about 50 members, that requires them to test every 6 months and test for a number of chemicals, including the two that we were talking about. And but they also don't require the lower level of detection, so they're sticking with their parts per million and saying that's our cutoff.
So one of these that you discovered, and there were chemicals found in many of them, but that there was a top one that you write about, where the Marquette lab did turn up pretty high amounts of the diacetyl chemical. How significant was that number when you talked to the labs?
It is the way we did our calculations. You know, we did micrograms per milliliter, and most vapors, again, the studies vary from what is an average vape per day, you know, between 3 milliliters, some studies say 5 milliliters. But we found, I don't have it in front of me, but it's roughly more than 80 micrograms per gram, which is essentially almost per milliliter, in one unit. So imagine if you do three of those. So it's higher concentrations, but the problem with this whole thing is that there is no safe level that anyone can agree and say this is safe. There isn't. There only is a framework of risk management, which is, you know, which compares it to the occupational exposure that workers will face when they spend their 8-hour days in there, and that's been a source of contention for folks who are looking at this and trying to determine how safe or not safe it is.
Raquel Rutledge is with us right now from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about a recent investigation by the paper that reveals that popular e-cigarette liquids contain harmful chemicals, a lot of the time without buyers or sellers being aware that they're there.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you an e-cigarette user or seller? If so, are you concerned about the liquid needed for the products or not something that worries you? Do you think we need more regulation of e-cigarettes and the products that go into them? Call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking right now with Raquel Rutledge of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. A recent investigation by the paper finds that popular e-cigarette liquids contain harmful chemicals. That's got some calling for stricter testing in the industry.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. If you're an e-cigarette user, why? And do you have concerns over what might be in the liquid, or is it not something that you're especially worried about? And what do you think? Does the vaping industry need stricter testing standards or not? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go to Jason, who is joining us in Marshfield. Jason, hi.
Yeah, I've been listening to the conversation. I guess my concern is, I hear the guests talk about how scientists have said and studies have shown, like the European scientists who did sampled 136 samples over six countries, lawsuits, litigation, and pentanyl and pentane and diaxyl and all this stuff. And in high school, we learned that to be tech talk. I'm wondering about the sources of all these studies because it sounds pretty convincing that e-cigarettes are bad, but it's like getting it from a neighbor. Where's the source? Thank you.
Jason, hi. And Raquel, maybe a little bit about some of the European testing, if you're familiar with that. And then maybe we can talk a little bit about the Marquette study and the North Carolina lab again that you used.
Sure. Well, the sources of the information about diacetyl being a danger and 2,3-pentanedione being dangerous are done by NIOSH, which is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And they've got dozens of those studies that are done by them. So those are government scientists that have been doing those studies over the last 15 years or so to establish that diacetyl is a danger. And then more recently, the National Institutes of Health has done the 2,3-pentanedione stuff. So that's the source for those things. The folks in Greece, like I said, is a cardiologist who teamed up with the folks from Enthalpy Labs to do the analysis on the e-liquids. And those studies are published. You can, they're in Tobacco Control. They're in the I've got them cited in my stories on where they're, like, who published these studies. They're peer-reviewed journals. They're not, you know, it isn't from your neighbor. These are, you know, credible journals that have been around that are publishing these studies.
And by the way, we've got that article up on the Central Time Facebook page. So, Jason, you're welcome to look there and read more about the investigation for yourself. Jason, thank you so much for that call. We're going to go next to Mark joining us in Stoughton. Mark, hi.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
You know, my boy, he's 33 years old, and he smokes one of them vapors. And I'm just wondering what's worse, them or cigarettes. Have they proved that? Anything on that yet?
All right, probably a lot of people wondering that. Mark, what do we know about how e-cigarettes compare to traditional cigarettes, Raquel?
Yeah, that is a great question. And the doctors, pulmonologists, scientists will debate that widely. So there, the facts are nobody actually knows. I mean, you can talk about e-cigarettes having far fewer carcinogens in them because they're just far fewer compounds than combustible tobacco. But then you also have other scientists saying, yes, but the vapors are deposited deeper into your lungs, into an area that's more susceptible to injury. And so, gosh, there, sorry to report, nobody actually has a truthful answer that, you know, there are studies on both sides that say, you know, this is, I talked to a pulmonologist this afternoon. He said, I would never encourage someone to switch to e-cigarettes as a, you know, as a way to get off of conventional cigarettes. Other folks, I've certainly talked to, Konstantinos Varsalinos is the guy who did the studies in Greece, and he absolutely advocates for, you know, switching over. So I cannot answer that question.
I don't think anybody actually can
until, you know, 15 years down the road.
Right. So it seems like we're sort of in the early days of the science on e-cigarettes, and it could be regulation will come into the picture. But Raquel, as we wrap up, what is the best thing for e-cigarette users to know and be thinking about as they make this choice about whether or not to use them?
Well, you know, buyer beware is what the FDA folks say, who are still working on trying to regulate them. So in the interim here, until if and when they actually do follow through with some of the proposals they've got out there to enforce some regulations, you know, you're on your own to kind of, there is no way to be assured. You can, hopefully you can ask folks to test them. If you're buying from a local vape shop, you can say, hey, do you test your liquids? How sensitive are your tests? Can I see the results of those tests? And those are all, again, those are only for the known compounds. I got to tell you, there's, you know, close to a dozen other compounds in there that are known to be respiratory, health risks. And so we haven't even dealt with those yet. So they're risky.
Raquel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Raquel Rutledge is a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us to talk about her investigation into the harmful chemicals often found in e-cigarette liquids.